The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. As a Harvard psychology professor, Dr. Timothy Leary researched using hallucinogenics for treating disorders. Here he is on the Merv Griffin Show in 1966, describing his first experiment with psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, in Mexico.
He brought over a bag of these mushrooms, and I ate seven of them. And I learned more about psychology, about the human mind, in those 5 hours than I had learned studying, doing research in psychology and treating people as a psychotherapist.
Leary was fired in 1962 for allowing undergraduates into the psychedelic studies. Related research at universities across the country ended when President Nixon signed the Controlled Substances Act in 1970. Decades later, researchers at prominent schools around the world are again conducting trials on LSD and psilocybin to combat alcoholism and soothe anxiety among the terminally ill. Last year, the DEA greenlighted a clinical study to test the safety and efficacy of MDMA, known as the street drug ecstasy, or Molly, for treating long-term depression and PTSD. One of the primary movers of these trials is MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. MAPS is holding global psychedelic dinner fundraisers across the country to raise money for research. There's one at Fireworks Restaurant in Brattleboro, Vermont, tonight. Rick Doblin is president of MAPS. He'll be speaking at the dinner tonight, and we reached him last week via Skype. Rick, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you very much, Virginia, for having me.
Well, MAPS, I know, does research on MDMA, LSD, ayahuasca, ibogaine, medical marijuana, but the focus right now is on more clinical trials for MDMA. Have I got that right?
Yes. Our main purpose is to develop MDMA-assisted psychotherapy into an FDA-approved medicine for post-traumatic stress disorder.
So where do you have to go now in terms of the testing phase?
Well, we have now, for the last 15 years, have had an international series of what's called Phase 2 pilot studies in Israel, Switzerland, Canada, and the United States. And we've got data from a whole range of people with PTSD, from war veterans to police officers to firefighters to survivors of childhood sexual abuse and adult rape and assault, workplace accidents. And we're gathering all of this data and preparing to submit it to FDA in what's called an end of phase two meeting. And the purpose of that is to plan phase three studies. And those are the large scale multi-site studies that are used to prove safety and efficacy to obtain permission for prescription approval.
So the DEA has greenlighted these clinical studies to prove that safety and efficacy. How much does that cost?
Actually, we've obtained permission from FDA, from regulatory agencies in the separate countries, from institutional review boards, and also from DEA. So it's a multi-regulatory approval process. And we're negotiating with FDA, which is the key agency, about moving to phase three. And what we need to do to make that happen is purchase medical grade MDMA. And that's going to be costing us $400,000. And that's what we're trying to raise from all of these global psychedelic dinners.
Wow, that's a lot of money. But let's talk a little bit about what these preliminary and pilot studies have yielded so far. You talked about some of the populations that you were working with. Give us some sort of concretes on treating, for example, PTSD.
Well, the first study that we did in the U.S. was 21 people. It was mostly women survivors of childhood sexual abuse, people who had PTSD an average of over 19 years and had failed on pharmacotherapy, which is usually SSRIs, Zoloft and Paxil are approved by FDA for PTSD, and these people had failed on psychotherapies. So these were people that were chronic treatment resistant, stuck with PTSD, and over 80% of them no longer had PTSD at the end of the study.
And how much time was that?
The study takes about 3.5 months, and then we test people 2 months after the last MDMA session. And during this 3.5 months, there's weekly non-drug psychotherapy, and every 3 to 5 weeks there's an MDMA session. And these MDMA sessions are with a male-female co-therapist team. They last 8 hours. They take place during the day. Then people sleep overnight at the treatment center. And then there's non-drug integrative psychotherapy for several hours the next day. And then we call people on the phone every day for a week after they leave the treatment center. So there's a very strong container for helping people deal with powerful emotions that have been plaguing them sometimes for several decades before they're able to really release those kind of emotions, integrate them, and move forward. And we've also done work with veterans, firefighters, and police officers. And it seems like MDMA has this remarkable property of reducing people's fear response to emotional challenges.
Yeah, so, I want to talk about that. I mean, we know a lot about what trauma's effect is now on the brain. From what I understand, or I'm going to say it in a way that I think I understand, you know, neurons travel a pretty well-worn groove that keep people kind of stuck or suspended in trauma that can easily resurface when triggered. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I would say the one nuance to add is that there's the fear processing part of our brains that act more immediate to threats, and that's where the amygdala portion of the brain reacts. And memories that are so traumatic when they happen, they don't get fully processed, and they don't get put into long-term memory. They're almost always happening, and that's why people with PTSD they see something that reminds them of the trauma, they hear a sound, they get triggered, and it's as if it's still happening. And so the neurons that are reacting quickly to fear like this, for those people that develop trauma, they can't really process it. So that the effect of MDMA is to help people calm down that initial fear-based emotional response, so that then when they're reflecting on the trauma, they can process it and put it into long-term memory so that it's something that happened in the past, something they've learned from, but it doesn't torment them throughout their day and night.
So MDMA takes it out of that sort of suspended space, that trigger response. How about long-term effects?
Well, we are only giving MDMA several times, 3 times in our therapeutic process. It's not like a daily drug, and it's given to enhance psychotherapy. And what we find is that there are long-term changes in how the brain processes these emotional memories. And there's a process called memory reconsolidation, so that it does seem like our therapeutic process can have lifelong changes. And we've done it for our first study, an average of 3.5 year follow-up, and found that on average, the benefits were even better at 3.5 years than after 2 months.
Well, you described a pretty intensive therapeutic process. Is that what the process would be like with a general practitioner or psychotherapy?
Yes, yes. It's really difficult when people are stuck into post-traumatic stress disorder to change those brain patterns. And it's something that can be done with psychotherapy without MDMA sometimes, but there's a large population of people for whom psychotherapy alone doesn't seem to do it. And the traditional pharmacotherapy with Zoloft and Paxil doesn't really do it either. And so you can make major breakthroughs in one moment with MDMA, but how do you integrate them and make them last? And that's where we have all of these non-drug psychotherapy meetings. So I think the treatment will be 3.5 months long. There will be some people that will get better after just one session. And there were some people in our research that got better after just one session.
Yeah, I read some testimonials, and I've actually heard some in doing research for this from psychotherapists and psychologists, psychopharmacologists, who were just stunned at the speed of things turning around. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's been a fair amount of research with brain scans with people under the influence of MDMA. And so what we know is that there can be a reorganization in the brain of how this emotional information is processed. And so basically, when you are feeling safe, which MDMA helps people feel safe, and the relationship that you establish with the therapist helps people to feel safe, and when you recall a traumatic memory, from this position of safety, from this position of saying, yes, that happened in the past, but it's not happening now, that can take the memory out of this short-term memory loop and put it into long-term memory. And then when you think about it again later, you can recall the trauma even better sometimes than ever before. You have more details about what happened, but your emotional tone is that feeling of safety.
Well, of course, there is a concern here that people would use it outside of the therapeutic environment once they get some good results. And we've heard this a lot about people here. We're having a huge problem with opiate addiction and overdoses in New Hampshire and in New England in general. And often the path is like, well, I had to take opioids or I was treated with oxycodone for pain, and then I became addicted. This is a tough road right now, Rick Doblin. I mean, here as in many other places, we're grappling with addiction. What do we know about the indications of MDMA and addiction?
Well, MDMA, like pretty much any drug, people could get addicted to if they really wanted to. But MDMA does not have a real high potential for addiction. And one of the reasons is that when the classic drugs that you get addicted to, like the opiates, you develop a tolerance to. And then when you take a, you get a tolerance, then you just take higher and higher doses to get the desired effect. With MDMA, when you get a tolerance to it, you try to take higher and higher doses and you get more of the stimulant aspects of it, but not more of the open-hearted peacefulness that people are looking for. It has a self-limiting aspect to it. And there's been over 1,100 people that have taken MDMA in clinical research all over the world since the early 1990s, and there's no reports of anybody getting addicted to MDMA from having been exposed to it several times in research.
Well, Rick Doblin, thank you for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. I'm very much looking forward to the dinner tonight.
Rick Doblin is president of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. They're going to be holding a global psychedelic dinner tonight at Fireworks in Brattleboro, Vermont. Details at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. In 1978, two clinical psychologists came up with the term imposter phenomenon to describe high-achieving people unable to take credit for their own successes, those who instead chalk it up to luck or being in the right place at the right time, all while living in fear that they will be exposed as frauds. Maybe you've heard it called imposter syndrome or seen the quizzes or articles or think pieces claiming to diagnose or treat the condition. Placement of articles like afraid of being found out, feel like a fraud, 21 proven ways to overcome imposter syndrome, suggest that they are aimed at women. And in recent years, imposter syndrome has become an easy explanation for why women struggle with disparity in the workplace. L.V. Anderson is associate editor at Slate, where she recently wrote about some of the misconceptions about imposter syndrome, beginning with labeling it a syndrome rather than a normal part of experiencing success. And we reached her via Skype. L.V., I'm told I can call you Laura.
Yes, you can. Well, thank you.
Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Virginia.
Now, you point out that this is not indeed a syndrome. So what is the difference between a phenomenon and a syndrome?
Well, a syndrome is a collection of symptoms that point toward an actual sort of a problematic psychological condition like depression or anxiety. And the difference is that a syndrome is something that is that kind of interferes with your ability to function or that causes a lot of internal distress. The imposter phenomenon or the imposter experience, by contrast, is a really normal thing that very successful and high-functioning people experience, which is feeling like you're in over your head a little bit, feeling like you have gotten where you are in part due to luck, and feeling like, you know, you don't necessarily deserve your successes.
So normal meaning that almost everyone experiences it. Are we calling that the good news?
I think it is good news. I mean, it doesn't sound like a great thing to happen to someone to feel like you don't deserve your successes. But if you like compare it to the opposite of like overestimating your abilities, I really think that underestimating your abilities is better. And I also think that getting the word out that this is an incredibly normal and common experience can be really helpful. I remember when I first heard about imposter syndrome, as it's called, I was just so relieved that like someone had identified this thing that I was feeling, and it made me feel better. So I think that simply talking about how common it is can actually be really helpful.
Give us a little background on the origins of naming the imposter phenomena. Where did it come from, and how did they describe it?
Well, as you mentioned at the top of the segment, Pauline Rose Clance and Suzanne Imes were two psychology professors in the late 70s who described it as, they call it the imposter phenomenon in the first paper that was written about it. And they identified it in high achieving women, including many college students, but also professionals who had reached high levels of success and felt like imposters, basically, felt like frauds. And so they thought at the time that it was mostly women who experienced this. And, I spoke to Pauline Rose Clance for my article, and she said that she didn't know when people started calling it a syndrome, but she thought, and I think this is right, that like people somehow just sort of think of the syndrome as being easier to comprehend than a phenomenon, or an experience phenomenon is sort of more abstract. So in the popular press, it became known as a syndrome. It's certainly not the worst misconception in the world, but I think it does lead to this idea that there's something pathological about it, even though there really isn't.
Right. And these two psychologists, both women, originally thought of it as a gendered phenomenon. But does the evidence bear that out?
No, pretty much all studies that have been done in which people have been given this this scale that Dr. Clance devised to sort of identify the imposter experience, shows that it appears in pretty equal numbers between men and women in various fields. And it's been identified in pretty much every population you could imagine. I think if you choose a population of people and you give a random sort of sample of them this scale, you'll find that like a high percentage of them in both sexes have this experience of feeling like an imposter.
Mm-hmm. So why then is it attributed more to women, do you think?
For one thing, just because at the beginning people thought this was a strictly female experience, that like that is just something that's stuck around in the culture, and it's sort of a hard to die kind of misconception. I also think that women talk about it more. It's more socially acceptable for women to talk about feeling like they're not qualified or feeling like they're not totally confident about where they are in their careers or in their educational experiences. And there's still a lot of social pressure on men to be totally confident and not to ever, you know, express any doubt. And so I think that that's something that still makes it hard for men to talk about it, even if when you give them a survey or give them a test, then they actually, you know, say that they do, in fact, feel this way.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that it's very easy and sort of simple to say, oh, well, women don't achieve as much as men. Women don't get promoted as much as men, and women don't make as much money as men because they have this internalized feeling of being imposters or this internalized insecurity. And so I think that it's sort of been glommed onto as a partial explanation for the glass ceiling phenomenon, even though when you look at the studies that have been done, it doesn't really make sense as an explanation for that because men and women experience it in equal numbers.
Yeah. Well, I'm also thinking of the opposite. You know, if a woman is perceived as, you know, having swagger or bravado, that can be a very negative thing inside of the workplace.
That's very true. I think that, you know, women aren't punished for having imposter syndrome. It's almost expected that women will not feel totally confident in their achievements, and so in a way, I think feeling this way, or at least expressing that you feel this way, can be a really adaptive response to the pressures that that women experience at work.
Well, every job that I've ever had has been a reach, you know, and I think of all the encouragement we get to travel outside of our comfort zone, move outside of that, you know, fake it till you make it. Is there an advantage to experiencing the imposter phenomenon, or at least identifying it?
I think so. There's a great essay on The Cut, I believe it was, by Molly Fisher, saying that she really likes her imposter syndrome because it motivates her. It feels motivating for her to feel a little bit like she is not totally secure in her successes. It makes her try harder. And Dr. Clance, one of the psychologists who identified the phenomenon in the first place, says that in the studies that she's done and just in talking to people who feel this way, she has found that like they are this humility that they feel sort of comes across and makes them more likable, which might actually be a factor in their success. So You know, as I said before, I think identifying this experience is helpful just to so that people who feel it feel less alone, but also just having it, having this like mild insecurity. So long, and again, I mean, if it gets out of hand, then obviously people can and should get help for it, and talking to a therapist can be very helpful. But a sort of like mild imposter phenomenon can actually be helpful for people in their careers and just in terms of, you know, functioning in the workplace.
Well, Laura Anderson, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on, Virginia.
LV Anderson, she's associate editor at Slate, and you'll find a link to her article, Feeling Like an Imposter is Not a Syndrome. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When you drive through most U.S. cities, a particular aspect of the landscape goes largely unnoticed. These are the vacant lots and median strips and tiny triangles of land in urban environments that are side effects of the automobile age. In the city of Baltimore, these overlooked, nameless public spaces have become the passion project for one man who's giving them a name to call their own. Roman Mars and Sam Greenspan from the podcast 99% Invisible bring us the story.
There's this 80s movie that I have a real soft spot for. I saw it in the theater, in fact. Now I get to show it to my kids. It's a good one, which is a good thing, because when your kids like a movie, you end up watching it over and over again. It's called The Neverending Story.
The Neverending Story? What's that?
The Neverending Story is a tale of a boy adventurer named
Atreyu!
He and his luck dragon named are trying to save the world from the onslaught of a terrible force called
Look, Atreyu! The nothing!
But this story also takes place inside of a book that's being read by a present-day boy. A boy named
Bastion?
Pretty much all the dialogue in the movie is written with exclamation points. Anyway, so Bastion the reader realizes that he is actually written into the story, and it's up to him to save the storybook world.
Maybe he doesn't know what he has to do!
What do I have to do?
Bastion winds up defeating the nothing. Spoiler alert. By giving the Empress of the fantasy world a new name.
He has to give me a new name. He's already chosen it. He just has to call it out.
It's really hard to hear, but he names her Moonchild there. I didn't know that for like 20 years. The power of one child's imagination saves an entire world. Seriously, it's a great movie. Anyway, there is a reason why I'm telling you this story. I want you to hold on to that idea that a name can defeat a nothing. Okay, with that in mind, here's our producer, Sam Greenspan.
Hey, Roman.
All right, everyone in listener land. Names versus nothings.
When I was a kid growing up in South Florida, there was this beautiful green place where I always wanted to go play. It looked perfect for a kid to run around and throw a ball. It was a flat mowed lawn that just stretched into infinity. But my parents wouldn't ever take me there.
Yeah, but with good reason.
It was inside of a giant highway interchange. My 5-year-old self would never have been able to convince my parents that this would be a good place to play, because no responsible parent takes their kid to play catch off the side of I-95. But I don't think I would even have known how to ask them to take me there, because this place isn't really anywhere that we think of as being a place. There's no name for it.
Let's call it a nothing.
As a kid, I couldn't look away from these perfect grassy areas. But as I grew up and became a driver, I learned to ignore them like everyone else.
So what happens when you give that nothing a name?
That's totally what I'm doing, giving things a name.
So this is my friend Graham.
My name is Graham Carell Allen.
Graham's an artist in Baltimore, and he has this project where he's trying to categorize and classify all the different kinds of invisible public spaces that we overlook. He published a field guide for how to spot them. It's part of a bigger project called New Public Sites.
New Public Sites is an investigation into some of the invisible sites and overlooked features of our everyday public spaces within cities that are not traditionally framed as public space. It's important to name these places because by giving these places succinct and fun and poetic names, we can help start a discourse about our public spaces and how we want to envision them for the future. I'm reminded of the Neverending Story. Bastion, you must give me a name.
Call my name!
See?
Graham gives these tours where he puts this language to use, describing incredibly boring pieces of the Baltimore landscape.
This is the first site along the tour, and here we have a void. I remember the building that used to stand here. It was painted blue. Passing through it, you can imagine how us as ghosts, should the building be standing here, would have to actually be invisible to pass through these walls, and now it's the reverse. The building is the ghost, and we're passing through its walls.
So Graham is really giving a tour of a vacant lot.
Vacant lot is one way to put it, but notice what Graham called it.
A void.
And if you pull up his book that Graham published, sort of a field guide to these new public sites, you'll see... All right, hang on. Okay, I don't have the book handy, but here it is as a PDF. I'm going to do Command-F, V-O-I-D. Okay, page 14. Void. A framed open space imbued with the psychic presence of a former mass...
And or the profound immersion of seductively infinite nothingness.
That certainly is a something. To find out more about these invisible public spaces, Graham and Sam rode bikes to the edge of East Baltimore to look at a few, like the one Sam pined for as a kid.
It looks like there's a small parting that we can actually see through. Right now we're at the foot of a small embankment that's probably 15 feet tall or so. We're gonna walk up to the edge of this embankment and meet a low-lying concrete wall that will safely separate us from the cloverleaf of traffic. Right beyond this this on-ramp onto, we'll be able to hopefully actually look into a freeway eddy. So let's do that right now. Darting across the street during a huge lull in traffic.
So we're looking at, there's this curved highway exit ramp coming in front of us, and it's maybe about 15 feet, 20 feet ahead of us. There's kind of this, almost like a wilderness area. Fenced in, there's no trespassing by Maryland Transportation Authority.
Correct.
With the invisible public space in sight, Graham turns to his field manual.
Freeway eddy, an interstitial fragment of space between intersecting curves of highway pavement.
And there you have it. That grassy non-place I'd always wanted to hang out in as a kid now has a name, a freeway eddy.
Graham's field guide to new public sites is full of new identities for these kind of places.
So here we have median refuge, a liminal zone of linear respite between parallels of churning traffic. Enlightened elevation, supple terrain providing the ideal incline from which one may gaze from a wise viewing distance.
Monumental isolation.
Big loose parts, movable materials that invite playful reconfiguration. It is actually an architectural term. Big loose parts. It's a pretty fun sounding term if you ask me.
Parallax of transit.
Triangle crossing. A three-sided concrete platform or asphalt zone providing solace for street crossing pedestrians.
I don't see too many pedestrians.
We have aural saturation. The overwhelming occupation of a surrounding soundscape by sight generated droning noise. Median refuge. A liminal pause of restraint. Empty signifier. A post or pole absent of its original sign and or meaning.
Seer's node. Soil horizon.
If there's a common theme connecting these sites, it's that they're mostly the empty, leftover spaces from car-centered city planning. And it's an odd celebration of these nothing places. Listen to how Graham describes them.
Beauty that one can enjoy. Spectacular and sublime. Quite beautiful. This is a really beautiful spot. We're actually standing right now in a long strip of sunlight that is created by the space between these two elevated highways. We're at the Chinatown bus stop across the street from the Baltimore Travel Plaza, miles outside of the city. Perhaps the most unglamorous way to enter Baltimore, and yet it's a gateway for hundreds a week, and it's a quite beautiful space.
Here's where I gotta draw the line, Graham, because there's some trees, there's some birds, you know, there's, I guess, some intent of landscaping this area around here, but, I mean,
It's basically a big parking lot with some trucks with diesel gas across the street. There's a subway. There's a bus stop. What are your grounds for calling this beautiful?
Let's be clear here. You can call that grassy patch off the highway a freeway eddy all you want, but I'm not going to take my kids to play ball in one. A highway exit ramp, by any other name, is still just as unattractive and dangerous.
This is beautiful because it's a space that's shared by so many, and yet it was completely undesigned. This space was designed as a parking lot, and it's become this huge nexus for people coming in and out of Baltimore. And so it's not necessarily what it looks like. It's more about what it represents.
Yeah, there's no denying that the experience of being in these new public sites is actually pretty terrible. But for Graham, the beauty is in their potential.
Sometimes everyday unremarkable spaces can become something more simply by virtue of people being there.
It's worth noting here that Zuccotti Park in New York City, the birthplace of the Occupy movement, was a privately owned space and not a public park. So if your goal is finding new spaces for engaged democracy to happen, as it is for Graham, then you need a way to redefine the places in your neighborhood where that kind of activity can happen.
And I think that's important, not to fetishize public spaces as only existing in town squares or Yosemite or Yellowstone or something like this. Not just the National Mall in D.C., for example, but any place. Our everyday public spaces, you know, the spaces that we all share, it's everywhere and we all have access to it. These spaces are the places where this happens. It doesn't just happen over the internet. It happens in physical spaces. New public sites are these physical spaces that we can appropriate, that we can make our own. If it's only for a temporary, you know, demonstration, then so be it. But maybe it's for a farmer's market. Maybe it's for a community garden. Maybe it's simply for a playground or a place where we need to add a few benches to make it a better bus stop. But nevertheless, there's potential there, and by giving it a name and by starting that conversation, we can kind of get these ideas moving into reality.
So it all comes back to a name against a nothing. When you give a nothing a name, you can reimagine it as a something.
If we can create terms for these otherwise invisible experiences and places and things that we all share, that we all of us share in these public spaces, these new public sites, then it's a starting point. It's a starting point for that conversation. By giving it a term, we can then talk about it, and we all know what we're talking about. Then that's the first step. The second step is envisioning, okay, well, how does this need to be improved? And the third step is, how do we do that?
The naming is where it starts. I don't know if I'd name anything Moonchild, though.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The great manors scattered across England are remnants of an empire past. Fans of Downton Abbey and Upstairs Downstairs get a glimpse of what it took to maintain these well-appointed colossal estates, namely a cluster of coordinated domestic staff. While most of us do not have butlers or kitchen maids or boot polishers to keep our homes up to snuff, their decades of dedicated experience and knowledge need not go to waste. Lucy Lethridge is author of Mind Your Manners, Tried and True British Household Cleaning Tips, and she's on the line with some tips on caring for your castle, or at the very least, some sound advice on spring cleaning. Lucy, welcome to the program.
I'm very pleased to be here.
So you came up with these ideas when you were researching what became servants. This is your book on people working in service from the 19th century onwards. So first, is that depiction that we see on Downton Abbey of servants known and integrated into the household accurate?
Well, it is up to a point. I mean, obviously, it would depend on your employer. And in Downton Abbey, Julian Fellowes is keen to portray a kind of mutually dependent upper and lower class. And that's part of a sort of conservative tradition of viewing class dependency as a kind of as a pyramid in which the upper classes are sort of fed and watered by the lower classes who are in turn looked after. That was not always the case. But in those large country houses, there was nonetheless a tradition of service and of care. So to an extent, it is true, yes.
So what would a typical day be like for, say, a maid working in an Edwardian manor 100 years ago?
Well, of course, Downton is much larger than a manor. I mean, Downton is what I suppose you might call a mansion. A manor is a more modest establishment, but would still have had, around, say, 1900, would still have had about 8 servants. And, of course, the earliest task of the day was lighting fires. It took a long time for the old houses of Britain to get electricity for a variety of reasons, and one of which, I think, was that there was a sort of anti-technological cult among certain sections of society, because there was a sort of cult of service, so that people liked candlelight, they liked or gaslight or paraffin lamps, which were tremendously arduous, and of course fires, which had to be lit for warmth every single morning. So that would have been the first task, and the kitchen maid would then have had to go and heat up the range, because that had to be kept hot all day for cooking, and it took ages and ages to heat up, maybe 2 hours. So she'd have been up at 6, making sure that that was lit, and they were notoriously hard to light. You know, they were always going off.
So after lighting the fires, then pretty much a whole day?
Depending on the nature of the house in which you're in, the job was to sort of order things for the day, to lay the tables, to make sure that the upstairs had hot water. That was a very big task, to heat the water and to take it up in pails upstairs. And it was estimated in 1890 that the average maid in a modest urban house carried 3 tons of water a week.
Wow.
And if you consider she'd probably be about 13 and probably pretty tiny and undernourished, that's quite something.
So we do have this impression that cleanliness, at least let's say personal hygiene, was not a big preoccupation in the beginning of the 20th century or late 19th. Was there a different standard for the household? Were they meant to be kept impeccably clean?
Oh, I think they were far cleaner than we are. I think the standards of cleanliness were enormously high. And this is partly because so much more dirt was generated. If you can imagine houses that have coal fires, leave a constant film of smuts and dirt. You had to be constantly cleaning. I mean, they used to clean all their books once a week, which is far more.
Wow.
Well, I don't know about you, but certainly far more than I never clean my books, in fact. I don't even clean them once a year. So, in fact, actually, because there was so much more dirt generated both in the house and outside, if you consider in this country, certainly most streets until, well, up to the First World War, were cobbled or earth. So that an enormous amount of dust was generated. So every time you opened a window, the dust from horses' hooves and wheels clattering over cobbles would come in through your window. So you were constantly cleaning this film that fell over everything. Whereas I think nowadays we, you know, take our antibacterial spray and, you know, do a few seconds darting about in the bits we can see.
Some cleaning has thankfully gotten much easier. Laundry you go through, for instance, changed radically. It used to be an all-day task, now done in a matter of hours. But without all these stain removers and OxyClean products that we have today, how did they get, say, a wine stain out of a tablecloth?
Well, I think that they were actually very ingenious. And, of course, a lot of our chemical stain removers now are absolutely lethal for fabric. I mean, we have fabric that is far cheaper and more disposable than they tended to have then. And part of that is because we destroy things so quickly. They just don't last very long, dry cleaning and so on. But wine was just a simple matter of, well, things that we probably would use now. So for red wine, things like soda water, and also stretching over a bowl and pouring boiling water through the stain as soon as you can. And that also does very well for things like ink stains as well.
Lucy Lethbridge is with us. She's researched the lives of maids and butlers and people in service in Britain's great houses. While most of us do not have a household staff, her book, Mind Your Manners, offers some tried and true cleaning tips gleaned from centuries of people in service. And Lucy, there's another concoction in your book that I would never have thought of. It's a tip for freshening a thermos.
It's you crunch up the shell of an egg, you put it into a thermos, you fill the thermos with vinegar and then with boiling water, you shake it around a bit, and then you pour it out, and you'll get the kind of cloudiness out of the thermos and the kind of the slightly sort of mildewy smell that you get when a thermos hasn't been opened for a while.
Lucy, how specialized would this kind of knowledge be? You know, would only laundry maids know how to get out a rust stain, or only kitchen maids, you know how to whip eggs properly? was it likely that one person would be dedicated to one job or a variety?
Well, it would, again, depend on your household. I mean, most servants in the last 200 years were working on their own. I mean, most people had one maid as opposed to eight, or the sort of Downton Abbey style. So a general maid would have had to know everything. She would have done the laundry and the washing up and the cleaning. But I think that housewives were expected to know these things because they were expected to teach their servants. It was part of the training. And Mrs. Beaton, for example, was written for the purpose of instructing young brides who had running their first home. She's not read by servants. She's read by housewives.
Oh, I don't know Mrs. Beaton. Is that a tradition in Britain in particular?
Oh, you don't know? Oh, Mrs. Beaton's Book of Household Management, which is absolutely iconic book here. It's never been out of print. It gets updated about once every 10 years. And it is the great volume. It is the great guide, first written in 1861, for running a house.
Will you include a recipe in the book for making one's own furniture polish out of beeswax? And for getting water stains off of furniture, how do you do that?
Oh, that's the most brilliant tip in the whole book, the water stains off furniture. That one I have tried, and it works superbly. And I tried it on an antique table very, very nervously. It's a very simple one. You use methylated spirits, table salt, and beeswax polish. You press the table salt, you sprinkle it onto the watermark, you rub a rag dampened with a little methylated spirit over the salt, and then immediately, within seconds, rub it with beeswax polish. And you do that until the stain disappears, which is amazingly quickly.
How about cleaning windows? There must have been a lot of windows in a manor home, or especially a grand estate.
Vinegar, or if you're feeling rich, gin. And newspaper, scrumpled up newspaper is, for reasons I'm not quite sure, but in fact is still used here by many window cleaners, is far, far more effective than cloth at getting rid of smears on windows. And certainly my window cleaner in London here always uses newspaper and indeed vinegar. He uses vinegar in hot water, but some people just spray vinegar onto the window.
Lucy, cleaning and domestic work now carry a lot of baggage. I mean, for women especially, I think, who work outside of the home, the idea of dedicating or priding oneself on the cleanliness of one's home feels outdated or even oppressive. So how do you, as a woman in the 21st century, look at that?
Well, I think it is problematic, isn't it? A lot of us here in London, where I live, employ cleaners, who of course are other women. I don't know anyone who employs a male cleaner, or I think they do exist. And so that we buy our liberation from cleaning at the expense of someone else having to do it for us. So I think that there is something problematic about cleaning, but I think that's part of the problem that we have about domestic labour. We don't perhaps give it the status that it deserves. It's very, very low paid work, and therefore we regard it as something that is unpleasant to do. And in fact, I think that there is some pleasure in mastering the details of how to look after things, how to keep them beautiful, to have beautiful things and to look after them, to have a really beautiful piece of wood and know how to nourish it, for example, rather than simply spraying it with a silicon.
Lucy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
I've enjoyed it.
Lucy Lethbridge is author of Mind Your Manners, Tried and True British Household Cleaning Tips, and Servants, A Downstairs History of Britain from the 19th Century to Modern Times. And if you're looking for more tips and tricks to improve your spring cleaning routine, you'll find a link to more on Mind Your Manners. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for listening today. There's much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org, and you can listen on your own schedule with the Word of Mouth podcast. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, rate it on iTunes. That'll help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.